So, I don't know, you guys, I know that you, Bill, have seen Melancholia, but have you seen Lars von Trier's Antichrist film?
Yes.
So, okay, you know, at the end of Antichrist, how he basically dedicates it to Andrei Tarkovsky, the guy who did Solaris,
And Stalker and just
and
genius.
yeah, all of those. And so I don't know, I thought it was interesting because this is, I'm totally jumping topic, but I hope you guys don't mind. I was looking at different images from Antichrist, just for doing Photoshop type stuff, and I come across one that's like the Fantastic Mr. Fox. And they took the poster for the Fantastic Mr. Fox and they put in Antichrist and they say Chaos Reigns, like it's like Antichrist, you know? And there's the Fox and fucking Antichrist, it's like Chaos Reigns and it's all, super intense and everything. But I was thinking it's funny because that's fucking George Clooney. And then George Clooney is the one in when they did the remake of Solaris, it
Okay.
stars George Clooney. And I was considering, like, if I was gonna do like what like a classic sync video where I take a bunch of clips and put everything together, I'm all about taking the Planet of Melancholia and like splicing up scenes of Melancholia with the planet approaching and Solaris when the Solaris is getting bigger, when the planet is getting bigger because they're using the thing to kill off the have you seen Solaris?
Yes.
Okay, so when they kill off their person, that shows up, and then the fucking thing gets bigger, that back and forth with the Fantastic Mr. Fox, with Antichrist, with the fox that is one of the three beggars. So there's the three beggars, and he goes, "That's not a real constellation," and like basically just all the levels of that. Anyways, that's like I got really into those three films, and I feel like there's definitely something there. And just Antichrist and Melancholia, there's so many parallels. The bridge, she crosses the bridge, the fact that it's Eden, is the name of the place that they go to, and then that is it Abraham is the name of the horse in Melancholia that won't cross that bridge. Abraham won't go into Eden. Like there's all of these layers to it. I don't know. Maybe I just need to write up a blog on it. I've been working on the sync book chapter, but maybe I need to put something up, just because that's like huge.
I'll say this about Van Trier and those two movies in particular. I stress this a couple of times, is that I feel lucky that I got to see both in a proper movie theater,
Oh, cool.
to see his work on a big screen, but also to see it in an audience full of other people reacting to it, because it's creating a tension in that room that is palpable. Because that you're seeing things that are on the screen, but you're also thinking things in your own head, and it just feels dangerous. It just feels alive. It feels like you're not watching something recorded. Something's happening, because you just don't know how people are going to react. And
Well,
a few people walked out of Antichrist, and I know a few people, you could almost feel them turn off from Melancholia because at a certain point they stop connecting with it. And I don't know. It's just so rare to see a movie in public with that kind of power. And I've yet to rewatch those films on a smaller screen. I don't know out of there's I know there's something there, but it's like maybe I'm waiting to see it on the big screen again, which I never will.
Well,
And
both those films I watched while Amy was in San Francisco, late at night, and both of them kept me up all night after watching them. And actually, Antichrist kept me up two nights in a row because I could not stop thinking about it. I was like, I watched the thing at 11. I finished at like 11 p.m. and then I couldn't fall asleep till like after 5 a.m. because I couldn't stop fucking going over it. And watching it alone in the dark is definitely a pretty cool thing too. So George Clooney is Batman. Okay, what do you got here?
Okay, so I didn't want to interrupt you. You were talking about George Clooney and the whole Fox. So George Clooney was Batman in the fourth Batman movie. The Morgan Freeman character in the modern Batman series, his name is Lucius Fox. He's the weapons, he's basically like the IQ of Batman, is Lucius Fox. So George Clooney at Batman, Lucius Fox. And then in the one with the Joker, the Heath Ledger Joker, he says he's an anarchist and his goal is to create chaos. When you were talking about the Antichrist, Fox creating chaos as George Clooney, I think that's really interesting.
Fucking perfect. Thank you. Yeah, no, I was thinking about George Clooney as Batman and just running around in circles with that. And these are like, so obviously the thing that's interesting in the first place is that Fox, obviously we associate with the sun. You have the fire fox as Fox is 666. So 666, Babylonian Sun Square, Fox is the sun. And which is also Aleister Crowley, right, if he proclaims himself the Beast. And then it's interesting because his successor, Jack Parsons, who designed all the Apollo jet propulsion, he labels himself the Antichrist. And so you have this relationship between the Antichrist as Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley as the Fox 666, which is perfect in the film Antichrist for the idea that chaos reigns, right? It's basically you're turning the tree around. It's like the false crown. And so I've been studying this whole thing with my teacher that is just blowing my mind. I don't know if I could give it complete justice, but basically there's this kind of esoteric idea around the tree of the three Vavs, and each relating to the Sphirot, one belonging to Gevura, one belonging to Chesed, and one belonging to Tiferet. And I was as soon as I heard that, I was considering this whole thing that's really kind of strange, because the Vav is the nail, right? And so I'm looking at 16th century text talking about these nails in the tree. And it's kind of strange because what do I think of when I think of three nails automatically, but the crucifixion, right? So Jesus is crucified with three nails, one in each hand and one at his feet, through both his feet, right? To hold him onto the cross. If you look at it as his feet, it's no longer Tiferet, it's Malkut, which is the Shekinah. And then what does Jesus have on his head but a crown of thorns, which would be in the placement of Da'at, if you take it that way. And what is a crown of thorns but a false crown, which is what Da'at is. And so there's this whole, it's like, in that sense, Jesus Christ himself is the Antichrist, because he's the one keeping the Shekinah at the base of the tree, which the European occultists take as Malkut. It's the same word for tip, which they take to be the clitoris of a woman, or the tip of the dick on the man, is the same word for feet. And so if you watch Antichrist, it's really interesting that she tries to take them back to basically fix the original sin by slamming a piece of wood against his dick and then cutting her clit off. It's like, it's very heavy imagery, but at the same time, it's all like just so perfect in terms of actual the symbolism. That's really straightforward. I'm sure everybody catches that it's the original sin because it's in Eden where this is taking place. But then at the same time, it's actually got Kabbalistic underpinnings as well beyond that. So anyways.
You know, I've been dipping into the canon, that book you recommended, David.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it's just almost too much.
Yeah.
I think there was a time when I could have just been lost in that book for a month, you know? And I think I'll get there. I'll spend more time with it over the years. But I can't imagine the energy of that guy when he was writing that book.
Yeah.
The connections he's just continually making. And I don't know if the book is very linear if he's approaching a final summation of his work, but it's just astounding. How the themes and the numbers just keep re-arising in every single place that he looks. And so, you know, when you think of a movie like Antichrist or Melancholia, you know, it's just so much more accessible to everyone to digest at first, you know, for at least to see the work from beginning to finish. But how do you ever get someone to start peeling at the layers, you know? I think the reason why people don't is because they realize that at a certain point you get to the level of which the canon is at. Yeah. And that's just – what is on the other side of really digesting a book like that from beginning to end? The problem is that you see too much. You know too much. And you become, I don't know, you lose a certain sense of security, you know?
A lot of that book is mathematical. I'm not that mathematically oriented. I can recognize its value, though. And so I think I told you this. I gave it to a mathematician friend of mine who, when he gave it back, was like, that is the, like, he was like, You don't get any more genius than that, basically. He didn't finish it. I would be amazed if he had. But he went through and checked all these things and was cross-referencing like crazy and working the stuff out himself. And it all checks out. He was like, it's all legit. It's not like Sitchin. You know, you're not like, wow, man, what a far out thesis. But Sitchin is more hung up on his ultimate conclusion in the first place, and he aligns the information to back up his conclusion, whereas this guy isn't interested in a conclusion. He's just processing information and dropping it, and it speaks for itself. Every part speaks for itself. You can see one conclusion that he has that he proves to the best that one possibly could prove, is that this text, I don't know if he mentions this, but it's what you can easily extrapolate, is that the New Testament is written in Greek. It was not written in Aramaic, and he shows why. And so when he goes into the Gematria and everything, not only that, but takes Plato's text and shows how certain pieces by Plato were all laid through with Gematria, and he applies probability theory to it, which is what you need to do, which is one of the most important things in sync that I think isn't really, it takes a lot to be able to do that. You know, if you want to make a proposal with something, it's one thing to make a visual connection or to say that these two things parallel, but then to have it get to a point where you're able to present it in such a way that you can kind of look at it through a mathematical lens and be scientific about it, like that guy does with the canon. He approaches the canon in a scientific way. He utilizes the scientific method, and so that's extremely valuable. How many people want to do that? You know, it takes a lot.
But it should be what it boils down to, at least for the common person, is to not recoil from it or to interpret it as madness just because it's so complicated and so foreign and so difficult to pierce, which I think is what the sync community is establishing, is that there are these pockets and these pools of like-minded people who can at least recognize that at this moment. You know.
I have not a huge concern, but in looking at the shootings and things going on, you know, talking about, well, what is their motive? If it was conspiracy, which, you know, whatever, I'm not claiming that, but I'm saying if there was a conspiracy, what is their motive? Well, first of all, that guy who everyone's so afraid of right now is basically, he looks like one of us. He looks like a young person who's thinking on lines that need to be considered. Yet here he is, become an object of so much fear for most of America. And we put our flags at half mast, you know, over what this guy did, out of an order from Obama, you know, across the nation. Everybody did that. And so it's like, I don't know. I'm like, wow, that's kind of fucked up. Like, somebody who people could relate to me is responsible for, you know, not just me, but a lot of people who are into this kind of stuff. And Batman is a huge source of synchronicity and deep symbolism. And so it's like, it's just, do you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm getting at?
Oh, absolutely. I saw the same with that guy, Jared Lohner. You look at Jared Lee Lohner's YouTube page, and there's things on there which I think are really, I mean, really interesting, where he talks about, you know, his reason for being against the government is because the way in which the government uses words, and he was all talking about, you know, what is language when words have no meaning, and like all these just sort of interesting areas of thinking. So there is the conspiracy side to it, and then there's the other idea of what if someone, you know, these areas of that, the things that we look at and the things, the sort of mental aerobics that we're doing are not easy on the psyche. Do you know what I'm saying? There are, I have to wonder if there are people who are able to get carried out in the tide with this. Chris Knowles had said something once which really, really stood with me. He referred to all this type of stuff, whether it's a occult knowledge, synchromysticism, all so the waters that we swim in. He referred to it as like surfing, and he said if you go to the ocean and you try and surf, you see the power that the ocean has, and you realize that it can drag you under and that people can die doing this, and it takes incredible, intricate balance to keep yourself from going under and from getting carried out in the ocean. And I think that's a very wise statement.
Agreed completely.
Yeah, Mark LeClaire said to me when we were all talking that I was going to have a nervous breakdown. He said, well, you're going to have a nervous breakdown. When he was turning into a robot, his voice. And I heard that, and I was like, maybe you do, but I've had so many nervous breakdowns. I mean, I'm like looking back on my life, and I'm like, I never have been checked into a place, but I've had plenty of total psychological meltdowns, and I feel like every time I've had that, I've come to the other side. But yeah, I was like, yeah, you need a 5-minute break, Bill?
Yeah, I'll be back in 5, but I just didn't want to miss anything.
Okay, should we take a break or?
Sure, that works. That works. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Awesome.
Now here's the youngster you read about recently in Life magazine. Is all the equipment okay there, Dick? Okay. Here from Boston and Quincy, Mass, and now the coast, Dick Dale surfing and a swinging. So let's have a fine hand.
Well, I looked at the heavens, they were moving in fast. I knew I better make it, cause they just don't last. I'm surfing, yeah, swinging and a surfing. Yeah, the sand and the sea is the only life for me. I'm surfing, yeah, just surfing. Hot dogging on my board, gonna have me a ball. Road a breaker in, and that was all. I'm surfing, yeah, swinging and a surfing. Yeah, the sand and the sea is the only life for me. I'm surfing, yeah.
back for sure. That Knowles analogy, which is great. It's really, you know, at a certain point, at some point you have to depend on the quality of your surfboard and what it is you choose to stand on. And, you know, any whacked out religious upbringing is going to force you. You're going to have to look at your surfboard at a certain point and make very big decisions. And I think people who aren't raised in even some of the mildest of religious upbringings, of just how difficult it is to hammer out the kinks in your surfboard when you have that embedded, especially at a young age. And I think it's a kind of mental imprinting that is, as everyone knows, that it runs real deep, but the process of rewiring that is like the great unstated and sort of you're left to your own devices when you go about trying to do that. And everyone can recognize it when it's some sort of 70s TV movie, I fell into a cult type of thing, about how the person can so easily be seduced and is lost within the confines of the cult. I think the best representation of it right now is Scientology and Tom Cruise, and how apparently he's got Scientology stalkers looking after his ex-wife and his children, and that these people are insane and they can't see it. But really what it all boils down to is, you know, brainwashing is just one side of it. It's belief, right? It's what all this work ultimately comes down to is your relationship to belief and what you choose to believe, and how long and how desperately you hold on to those things. And I think when you start tinkering with that part of your psyche, the waters are always raging, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's always an ocean, and it's the perfect wave is always, the perfect storm is always just around the corner.
That's well said. I mean, you know, this is the thing. If you want to be any kind of psychonaut, whether you're taking psychedelics, exploring synchronicity, the murky waters of internet conspiracies, and anything, any kind of psychonautics, you know, just like it is with aeronautics, not everyone makes it. Not everyone, and it's things like that that kind of sober me up a little bit and make me, you know, we were talking before about, you know, it's one thing of a difference of opinion within a community and where, you know, we sort of occasionally have to draw lines in the sand and say, like, I can't get behind that idea. You know, I mean, I'll be honest. So, I mean, last week, actually, the last 2 weeks, I was, you know, it was weird. It was like there was a point in our conversation, Bill, where I thought to myself, I'm glad Bill's here. I'm glad he's presenting a different side of this argument that my mind just doesn't work that way. I'm glad he's here to present me with a different option. And then you said some things where I was like, what the fuck? No.
the people on the moon, living on the moon. You had some challenges around the idea of law and what possibilities are in terms of what things would look like. And you were arguing about the Star Trek being a show and not an actuality.
Yeah, but it stems out of, I think, you know, we were talking about like different you know, TSA and what kind of security do you need for this society and so on, so on. And, you know, maybe this is the same kind of thing. It's like, I don't, so let's say our sink community, you know, let's say there's some dangerous waters that people are swimming in. Do we prohibit certain types of thinking because they're potentially dangerous? No, but we can discuss it and we can challenge it. I think that's the healthy way to do it. You know, for whatever role I have in this, you know, I put Jake's interview up on SyncBook website so other people can listen to it. I'm essentially promoting what he said by putting it up there on my site. And yet, you know, we can discuss it. And it's, my thing is to not censor it, to not disallow the conversation or the other point of view, but nonetheless to challenge it.
Right.
I think is the healthy way of doing it. And the same thing would apply to actual, you know, physical security measures and things like that. You know, I saw my father this week. It was my niece's birthday, and I saw my father, and we had a fairly similar conversation. My wife and I were complaining about our experience with the TSA, and he was like, well, you know, they gotta... You know, they have to stop people. They have to be very strict. Otherwise, you know, something bad could happen. And I was like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. There's a line that's been crossed. That I think is, and I don't mean to make the comparison between CATE and Homeland Security or TSA. That's two very different things. I'm just when I use the same language, say. A line has been crossed. You know, we know with these body scanners, we know that they're not effective. We know that the Congress and Senate owned stock in the companies to put these in. So this was purely a financial move to do this. I don't see why we should have to comply with this. And his thing is like, well, of course people are going to try and make money. That's what people do. But we still need the security. It's like, my thing is, no, if it's a total bullshit move, you don't do it.
Uh-huh.
But it's a really difficult thing. So, what is that? We're in a situation where, do I not fly? Do I choose to be molested instead of going through the body scanner? What are my choices, essentially? And they're not very good choices. And how do we present different choices?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it speaks to that kind of those dangerous waters or that psychonautic space is that when you go in there, you don't get to choose what content arises. So when you're not in that psychonautic space, you should try to at least build some representation of it. So all content should be considered. The moment you start censoring any content in a conversation is the minute you are not being true to that sort of subconscious ocean that you know all of this really takes place in, or at least simultaneously takes place in. And you're basically just setting yourself up for failure the next time you re-enter that kind of space, which ultimately is where we go when we transition from this body to the next. You know, we will always meet up again in those waters. It's just where we go. At least that's what I've been led to experience or feel like I've been shown.
But I was trying to make this argument last week, and I'll just sort of bring it back up. You know, what if someone said, I mean, as it stands, we've made psychedelics illegal. I would assume you disagree with that move.
Yes.
Fuck, man. I'd say we're in a process. I mean, there might have been... I don't discount that there might have been some higher level understanding of how to reintroduce psychedelics to the West.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So you've taken psychedelics. So you obviously did so illegally.
I broke the law.
You broke the law. Shame on you, bad man.
Shame on me.
Now, my thing, though, is that you decided, you know, this is a silly law. Or maybe you think it's a good law, but you felt that you took it upon yourself to say, I don't think I need to factor that into my choice. This is something I want to do regardless of someone saying I can't. I'm going to do it anyway.
I just thought it was sort of like, I don't know, running a stop sign at 3 a.m. or no one's around. I won't get caught. So the law breaking didn't happen.
I'm not trying to. So that's an interesting answer. I mean, I'm not trying to make issue. I don't agree with the law. So I don't think that you did something wrong. My point is, if you didn't think it applied to you, why should it apply to others? What makes you special? What if the idea was, you know, all right, you've taken a psychedelic, but you can only, you know, what if there was some sort of TSA for psychedelics? So you could only take it in, you know, a hospital room with a bunch of scientists standing around you, poking and prodding you and taking your pulse at every moment to ensure that you're safe to fly, that you're safe to go into these, you know, headspaces. You have to be fully checked out first. I think that would really taint your experience, no? The idea of being on psychedelics with a bunch of people standing around me, poking and prodding me, freaks the shit out of me. Could you imagine how terrible that must be?
You know, LSD was made illegal in 1966, right? Mm-hmm. The big scare, like when people became scared of LSD, was the Tate murders, right? That was like the thing. Like people were like, oh, that's the dark side of what acid can do, right? For most people, like that was, for most of America who didn't know much about it in the first place, for a lot of people, they were really affected by that. I find it interesting that the Tate murders occurred on August 9th, 1969, and that Woodstock was less than a week later, on August 15th. It started on August 15th and ended on the 18th, 1969. Considering that, you know, the Aquarian Exposition that was Woodstock was like such a fucking strong statement of, look, we have this many people. They're not taking the brown acid for the most part, are generally like having 3 days of nothing but peace and love and music. And then this group of people did these terrible things. It's just, I don't know.
Just to clarify, that was 1969, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You said 66.
No, it was made illegal in 66.
Right.
It's made illegal before any of this happened. Right. I'm saying,
okay, I thought you were saying it was made illegal because of these murders.
No,
that was years later.
No, I was saying that was, it was still, it was made illegal in 66. Mm-hmm. But then, which is interesting because, I don't know, it seems like they had other reasons. But the scare, people still weren't scared of it until, like, in any, like, in other than because of propaganda. Until the Manson shit. And so I'm just saying, I'm just making that point that something's illegal, people don't see any, like, for the most part, any reason why it should be illegal, even though it is, a lot of people, if they've taken it. But then the Manson thing is the first time too that people who had taken it were like, oh fuck, you know, still, like, those people were scared of it too. Now, I don't know.
David, let me add to your context, because I've actually been thinking about this the last few weeks. So you mentioned that the Tate murders happened a few days before Woodstock, which I've noted, and that this all happens less than a month after the moon landing.
Right.
So now let's consider that Roman Polanski makes Rosemary's Baby essentially about making a moon child. And then his wife is killed within weeks of the moon landing with her. Exactly, exactly. With her unborn child. It's almost as if, and I be very careful how I say this, not to give credit to these crazy people who did horrible things, but it's almost as if someone was trying to prevent a moon child from being born.
Yep. Super fucking weird. I know. I totally consider it, and I also consider it from the angle that the child was not to be Tate's child, but if you took it on a certain level, you could. I could see how, if you were following the sync of it, you could get that sense. Or that's almost like a decoy or something.
What I mean? Something, exactly. There's like some sort of weird overlap between those ideas. Like I said, particularly that it was within weeks of the moon landing and that Polanski's wife and child are killed, I think is really interesting.
You know, to go back to the legal, illegal notion of a drug like LSD, I think it's important to go back to the 60s. And my understanding of, you know, legal versus illegal when it comes to drugs was really pretty much non-existent. You have movies like Cheech and Chong that are celebrated as, you know, part of the fabric of American comedy, and they're on screen essentially breaking the law. And, you know, they avoid the police, or maybe the police catch them, but it's put up there on the screen as kind of a joke. And it's pretty much well understood that people smoke pot every day. Just don't get caught. Don't be stupid. I mean, it's the act. The act itself isn't illegal. It's what you do while you're doing the act. So
are you familiar with Traveling Wilburys' song, Tweeter and the Monkey Man, where he says, "In Jersey, everything's legal as long as you don't get caught"?
The Garden State, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that in a park in San Francisco, or at the Fillmore, what have you, and everyone there was taking LSD legally, in your mental framework, you're not doing anything illegal. You're doing something that supposedly is ultra advanced. It's at that point, it's considered the best of the best of what human ingenuity can accomplish. And if everyone else is also ingesting it, there's that sort of veil that tells yourself that, well, all the people can't be wrong. This can't be bad for me. They're doing it as well. It blankets you with a certain security. And then obviously when the LSD happens, I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in a concert hall or in a park with several hundred people also on the drug, but without that blanket of illegality, or it's somehow being subverting the government. That it's just that place, and that place in time, and those emotions, and those sounds, and everything. So I don't think people could really have a bad experience.
You could almost see the high watermark.
Yeah, where the wave finally broke and rolled back. One of my favorite things, actually, is one of the things that bothers a lot of people about Burning Man, and it can go on the wrong way too, but I like to see a police officer standing looking at a show that is so far beyond anything he's ever fucking witnessed before, and the expression on his face of helplessness when he doesn't know how to approach it. Because a lot of times they just walk around and they bust people and they do their thing, and they actually have vision so that they can spot things at night, and they'll just pull people out of groups left and right you know. But then there are times when they're just, and there's a lot of narcs, obviously, who are look like other burners, but they have their signals and they're all communicating with each other and they're picking people out. But when sometimes they'll just be standing there and they they won't know what to fucking do. And they just look so, I don't know, like they're afraid on one level. And then on another level, they're just like, they can't process it very easily. That there's just so much happening, the amount of stimulation and everything. But then when they see that these people are just doing what they're doing, there's like nothing bad happening. And it's just, this thing is happening and it's so beyond their control. I love that.
No, do people approach the cop in that moment? Do they, or is it just a sphere of do not address or ignore around the police officer?
Depends. Sometimes people talk to them. Sometimes they don't. You know, it depends. I've had many conversations with police out there a number of times, including the chief at one point. This fucking decorated guy was like 5 days after Burning Man, and he's rolling around, and he came up and he was asking us questions about how we pay for our camp, and was like very interested in all these nuances and things, and was asking about Google. He had heard that the people, other sound camps had corporate sponsorship and was just interested in that. And he was really neat guy, actually. He was like, yeah, you know, we didn't used to like this kind of music, but now, you know, we've been coming out here for so long. We come out here when there's no one else here. This guy's a Reno cop. And he was just like, you know, we go and we blow shit up and we listen to house music the whole time when we're off work and stuff. And it was just like, it was totally like he was relating to us, you know, in a way. But yeah, he was a really genuine dude. You know, I get it. It gets bigger and bigger, and then that's part of it, is my only point, is the integration that happens through exposure. And the fact that he's standing there wearing a uniform and he's playing a certain role and he's doing a certain job. But there comes a point where he has to reflect, and that reflection point, I mean, if he's there for a fucking week and he's seeing all this stuff, and there's times when there's just no one, you know, he can try and stay busy the whole time, but he has to reach threshold points where he just has to take something in. And it's at those points that I feel I'm really entertained by, you know, it's like when he's looking at it and he doesn't know what to do, you know, I like that.
Well, isn't that sort of individual, if you turn that individual into just a bigger kind of paradigm, that it would be like the whole dose the water system kind of revolutionary act, that if the individual policeman standing there, not being able to process what was happening, if you could somehow, how illegal is this, unknowingly put him in touch with what was going on in that psychonautic space, albeit this method would be, you know, having him in contact with the psychedelic.
Well, this is the thing, is that what's happening is more than just the psychedelics. What's happening is communication.
And okay,
so,
yeah.
So many people coming together, and some people of them are in psychedelics, and a lot of them aren't. A lot of people just go there, and they only take psychedelics one night of the week. And there's a night that's designated for that, actually. A lot of people, that's how they approach it. They're like, this is when we do it, and the rest of the time, you know, and you can't smoke pot there. Good luck, you know.
Really? I mean,
some people do. I never do. Because
why
just
not?
Because it's an easier way to get yourself noticed with that. You're putting smell out there. And
really?
And at night especially, they have, like, shit that they can see through, you know. And they'll snag you. You'll disappear, basically.
That doesn't even seem real, man.
It's true. I mean, I've seen it happen.
I know you've been there. I can't even comprehend that.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone for a walk and seen someone leaning over talking to a police officer, And my friend stops me and he points it out and he's like, hey, check this out. You know, and we follow this guy after he talks to him and he's got this big blue lightsaber. And he goes to this group of people that are all have different blue lights, like, I don't know, somewhere between, I'd say 25, 30 people, something like that. And they all are huddling together and they all split up into this crowd. And he waves his lightsaber in the direction of the cop right after they all talk, you know, and they look like everybody else, you know. But they go out and it's probably kids have gotten in some kind of trouble, you know, and they're like, hey, free ticket to Burning Man. You just have to help us like one or two of the nights or whatever it is that they have them do. And they agree to it. So, you know, whatever. I mean, I feel like there's things that are that go beyond the simple issues like of the drug issue. There's also something else taking place. And when people talk about Woodstock, you know, it's not just there's drugs involved and whatever, but it's also an experience. And you have that many people actually communicating. The communication is what it's all about. And people who are there for law enforcement at some point have to recognize that. There's no way around it. And the elements, the fact that all these people are enduring a lot of the element stuff, you know, you have dust, you know, sometimes where you can't see for a full day practically, you know. So, you know, whatever. I mean, I feel like there's more taking place there than just a simple matter of illegal substances, you know, though that is part of it.
You know, my only comparable environment to relate to would be the last few fish shows I've seen in the Chicagoland area. What with the parking lot outside before the show, the show itself, and then the sort of aftermath around the parking lot. And it can be comprehended by an outsider and maybe even by someone who's there as just people getting fucked up, you know? But I obviously don't see it like that. It provides an environment that is just sorely lacking, and can be very rare to experience on that grand a scale. And I think that the people involved in the production of their tours have done a pretty damn good job of sustaining it for 20 plus years and providing that outlet for people, especially for the person embedded in a working lifestyle to be able to once a year kind of get lost in there for a little bit. But the thing that I find amazing is they have these events in public places, you know, clearly. And with the way the laws have been in Illinois, there's no smoking of cigarettes in public places, and certainly there's no smoking of marijuana in public places. But I've been to Toyota Park in Bridgeport, and I've been to UIC Pavilion, which is an indoor facility, and I can tell you that it would be impossible to prevent those things from occurring. And even just from a tobacco standpoint, which if you lit up a cigarette in a bar or any public place, the people around you would shut you down before a cop got to you to write a ticket. But because the entire horde of people accept this as part of the environment, and I don't know, it's
true.
I'm sure people get arrested for very, very blatant and disregard for certain laws, but there's a vast majority of people who are breaking the law in plain sight, and it's just it's not addressed.
It's funny. I've gone to many concerts where I could just light up a cigarette or light up a joint, and there's really no issue. You know, even Madison Square Garden, you know, there's a ton of security there, but no one's really doing anything. Every now and then someone might say, like, hey, put that out. And then they walk away, and then you just kind of, you know, if you're holding it up by your face, and then they walk by and go, hey, put that out. And then you just put it down below your seat, and then they walk away, and then you pick it back up. you know, but the only time I actually ever saw someone get in trouble was for someone with a video camera got in trouble. But I've never seen anyone get in trouble for smoking. I've never been in trouble for smoking either tobacco or marijuana at a concert.
It's kind of like the speed limit sign on a highway. You can always go 10 miles per hour above it. It Whoa. Seems like that's the best way to control a huge population of human beings is to set a law, put signs everywhere, this is the law, but give them that wiggle room. Give them a certain amount of freedom to make them feel like they're in control. But to a certain, there's a certain paranoid way of thinking that at any moment they can decide, hey, you were going 5 miles beyond the speed limit. I'm writing you a ticket for speeding. And you say, but everyone knows you can go at least 10 miles above. Everyone around me was going 10 miles above. And they can look at you and say, the sign says 55. You are going 60. That's speeding. Here's a ticket. You can't combat that. And if that happened on a societal scale with all the laws that we have on the books, all the wiggle room was immediately taken away, I think maybe that's what you're feeling since 9/11, right? Is that the wiggle room got so big that an event happened that put the squeeze on the wiggle room.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not talking about putting the squeeze on the wiggle room. I'm talking about motherfuckers with machine guns on my subway.
No,
that's what I'm bothered by. I'm bothered by that I can't go into the subway without motherfuckers with machine guns and German shepherds, like full fucking body armor, like something out of a fucking Nazi nightmare.
Well, Alan, I think maybe that's what I think this is very carefully trying to get to, that maybe the way the society really is that's what it is, right? But when times are fat and there's a lot of dough in everybody's pockets and technology is booming and foreign relations are, you know, not bubbling over, that the machine gunners, you don't see them. That we always have lived in a machine gunner on the subway society. It's just in certain times of financial, I don't know, whatever it is, you just don't see them. Everyone can drive 10 miles above the speed limit. But really, the law says 55. You know, like the law. I guess that's what I'm trying to like build towards, is that
you
kind of see the way things really were if you had eyes to see.
Yeah, I think probably the mentality was always there, but I think there is, and again, this I don't see this as wiggle room. I see this as, if anything, it's the opposite of, you know, sort of we, as far as, you know, citizens with civil liberties, we gave the police some wiggle room and said, okay, we understand that, you know, there's a need for some sort of safety measures to be in place, so we'll allow you to infringe upon our civil liberties this much. We give you some wiggle room. It's okay if, you know, I don't mind there being a cop on the subway platform, because if someone gets, you know, if someone gets mugged, hey, then there's someone there. As long, you know, he's not harassing somebody. He's just there as a presence. That's a wiggle room. That's fine. I think it goes to the extreme when it's, you know, being randomly stopped and searched, which is, of course, unconstitutional. It's not wiggle room when just today the NYPD announced that they've put in this vast spying system so that they can keep track of automobiles, faces, you know, they can millions of cameras, this vast tracking system, so they can basically track everyone in the city. Now, this is only within a certain range so far, although it's really interesting that they're saying that they can track all citizens and they're saying that they can track if, say, let's say something, they find that you did something, like, so one of their examples was, if a bag is left somewhere, we can go back to the tape, see who left it, and track them back days, weeks, or months. Well, how would you be able to go back months? So you have this vast system that perhaps is outside of the area you're claiming, or the one argument would be that they're over-exaggerating their assets or their ability to spy. However, I know that's not the case, only because I had a friend who was working for a local police department after 9/11, and he was telling me, he was all excited about it. Oh, we just got a ton of stuff from Homeland Security we didn't have to pay for. Homeland Security gave it to us. We got these cameras with facial recognition software, and we got all these cool new, you know, tools and computers and all this stuff. And it's like the greatest, you know, it's like a kid at Christmas. We got all these cool toys from Homeland Security. And I'm like, motherfucker, you're talking about facial recognition cameras on the street. This is not, you know, this is Big Brother. I'm sorry, I don't think this is a removal of wiggle room. I think this is a leap to a blatant stance. You know, it's, I think that's what I, like, it's the same thing we under George Bush, right? Let's take it this way. When George Bush was president, everyone was freaked out. There was a huge anti-war movement, a huge civil liberties movement, and then Barack Obama comes in and suddenly it vanishes like a puff of smoke. Boom, fucking gone. The policies have stayed the same. If anything, we've invaded five more fucking countries. We've done a lot more horrible stuff. Obama has supported and expanded upon all the things that Bush did, and yet there's this air. This is, you know, you're pretending that, oh, you can go 10 miles. This is your wiggle room, has, you know, pretends to come back. So I understand your argument in that case. I think what we get frightened by is when it's really blatant. So right now, Barack Obama's in office. Most people aren't worried. Oh, it's good. We got a progressive liberal president in power. We're not in any trouble. Nothing's wrong. No reason to protest, to be upset at anything. And, you know, and if you do, then you're some sort of, you know, xenophobic racist who hates black Muslims or something. You know, it's like total, you know, you can't complain without having some sort of. And that's not to say that there aren't people who are upset with a black president. I think just to say, this whole like birth certificate issue, this is sort of a tangent, but I just want to sort of go on record here. The birth certificate issue and all this idea, the idea that you would impeach Obama for this offense, I think is very telling as a racially motivated thing. Because if you really wanted to impeach the motherfucker, you could. Because he did the same thing George Bush did. The same reason that charges were brought up against George Bush to be impeached were for unconstitutional wars and for infringing civil liberties. You could impeach Barack Obama for the exact same thing. He has invaded five countries without a declaration of war. You could impeach him for that, but no one wants to do that because no one wants to stand up against war. People just want to stand up against the black guy. So I do think that that birth certificate issue is racially motivated. Nonetheless, I think there are real issues that we should be worried about. The same things that, like I said, that were very obvious under Bush that are still obvious, but people have seem to gloss over again. And I think there is something frightening about the in-your-face, I don't give a shit what you think. Yes, I'm going to put a machine gun in your face. Yes, we're going to act like total Nazis and we don't care. I think there's something extra frightening about the blatant and bold maneuvers like that rather than some clandestine, you know, groping behind the scenes, which of course we should be aware of, but there's, you know, always the hope of, well, these guys are trying to seize power behind the scenes, or they're trying to do something, whoever they are, right? So we get into that really murky area, and then it's always so easy to sort of question. But when it's really blatant and in your face, I think it is worrisome. It's extra worrisome because they no longer give a shit. It means, yeah, we know that we're going to, when you go to the airport, we're going to tell you, put your hands up like you're under arrest spread your legs and we're going to take naked pictures of you, and that's okay. And if you don't like it, then we can molest you and we can, you know, we can stop you on the street and we can threaten you with attack dogs and we have cameras tracking you at every moment of the day. And if you don't like it, well, then you're some sort of anti-American terrorist, Muslim, liberal something. You know, it's like
crazy imagery, that whole idea of flight, that there is this sort of bottleneck for flying now, that you have to decide, you know, just how much scrutiny and how much of the squeeze you're willing to accept to fly, to jump from one place to the next. You know, there's a sort of death, rebirth, very old Christian, you know, it's like a judgment day, you know, that you're like picked apart and you're scrutinized and you're, and you know, you're balanced by the weight of a feather just to get onto an airplane.
But by calling it a symbol of judgment day, it's implying that a bunch of fucking really sadistic Nazis are somehow have been elevated to godhood. And I don't, if that's what we're equating, then no, I can't tolerate that.
Well, it's stunning in its obviousness, right?
Yeah. I mean, what I'm really confused about is I listened to your interview with Mark LeClaire. When David and I were in Boise, you and Mark LeClaire had a conversation and you were talking about conspiracy. And you were talking about when you became aware of conspiracy and all this stuff. So it was, it seemed like this idea of not distancing yourself from it, but saying that you were aware of some sort of conspiracy. Now, you guys never really went into what that conspiracy was, but I find it, I'd like to sort of hear you expand upon that. If there is...
The conspiracy is very, very simple for me.
Yeah.
Or at least the conspiratorial perspective on human history, right? Because it's that one foot in reality that LSD brings you to, that you say, everything's going to be okay. Everything is joy. This moment is beautiful. You know, I had that epiphany of, why do I drink so much alcohol? Because I was drinking a lot of alcohol in college. I was like, I don't need alcohol. I just need to be with the people I love and exercising and working towards good things. And I can spend the rest of my existence just manifesting joy into the world, you know. But because I was surrounded by a television and newspapers and what other kind of things, I had another foot in human history. And a sort of architecture of momentum that I started to think of, well, I didn't just discover something brand new here, and I'm on a drug that supposedly is illegal, and it was made illegal for what reason? And I said, you know, if I had this available to me, I would probably take this once or twice a year just to get everything in line, and the whole conspiracy blossoms from there. Is that if I can see the power of this experience and how it can extend not just into my past, but also into my future, that, you know, that other people are aware of this.
I think the FBI is knocking on someone's door right now.
Yeah, I heard that.
But like, you know.
But then, so that's why I'm equating the psychedelic, the restrictions on psychedelics to the restriction on civil liberties. Do you ever see the movie Into the Wild?
Yeah.
You know, when he has like a canoe and he goes to the river and the guy says, oh, sorry, you need a permit to go in the river. And he's like, all right, well, can I have a permit? And they're like, well, you need to get on the waiting list. And he's like, well, the river's right there. And they're like, no, you know, sorry. And it's like all these, this bureaucracy that's put in place of, you can't go in that, you can't step into the wild without permission and approval from your government. And to me, that's the perfect metaphor for psychedelics. You can't step into the wild regions of headspaces with, where we don't let you. No, sorry. You need our approval and we're not giving it to you. Even if you got your canoe and the river's right there, sorry, we don't want you to. And if you do it, you have to do it with one eye over your shoulder looking back, that I hope the guy with the machine gun's not coming after me.
Okay, so when all this starts flooding into my brain, and I'm exposed to it for the first time. And this whole nature of conspiracy is flooding my brain, and all my education that was stored in my brain unfolded in front of me, and I reread history as I knew it. And I'm starting to see it through a different lens, and all these things are connecting. And it's funny, at the same time all this epiphany of history and what maybe is a conspiracy is happening, there was a song by a group called Spiritualized on called, it goes, run, 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 run away. And I mean, that was my feeling, was that run away from this conspiracy. It's a death culture. It's exploiting you, and it's fixing to kill you in whatever way possible. But then you realize there's nowhere to run, or at least that's where my position was at that point. I could have reacted externally. I could have wanted to not be the victim. I might have wanted to make other people the victim, you know? And it's that point where I just had to stop and just let it happen, right? And just put that on the shelf as a perspective. And that's kind of where it's always remained, as a perspective.
And I understand that. I mean, I think I agree with you that the conspiracy community is a death culture. I very much agree with that. I think there's something extremely a fascination with darkness, and continually being surprised that I looked under this rock and I found something scurrying, and I looked under this rock and I found something scurrying. I wonder what happens if I pick up this rock. Yeah, guess what? Surprise, surprise, you're always going to find something scurrying. I think this is, you know, the truth of nature, and, you know, I don't feel like this. People go on these, like, conspiracy crusades where they have to keep picking up rocks for the rest of their life to figure out, oh my God, here's another thing. I don't think that's necessarily the right way to do it. And it's the same issue I have with, sync studies, where people just, oh, and this connects to this, and this connects to this, and this, you know, it's like you can end up on that same endless rabbit hole. But it doesn't mean, you know, does it mean that if I know that if I pick up a rock, I'm going to find something scurrying. I know if I look at the voting record of a senator or his campaign contributions, I'm going to find something dirty. All these things are absolutely true. So it doesn't mean that I have to keep doing it, but the perspective, hopefully, is that it's not that you get lost in paranoia, but hopefully that you learn a lesson, is that, I don't know, maybe this is, I don't, for me, it's that I no longer trust those people to make any decisions for me. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think it's like, you know, I don't feel a need to go blow up, you know, Congress. I don't feel the need to go fight a revolution. It just means I'm going to make up my own mind, and I'm going to decide what's right for me, what's wrong for me. That, I think, if you just put everything on the shelf without at least gaining something from it, then what was the point of going into that dark space in the first? Like, it's like any dark night of the soul. I view my time with into conspiracies as very much a dark night of the soul, but I feel like I came out of it stronger. And if you don't, if you just go, you know, it's like, what's in room? This is the thing, you know. Jake Coetzee, again, just to bring him back up, I mean, he spent a lot of time. He was a huge conspiracy guy. And he spent his time in room 237, but now won't talk about room 237. There ain't a goddamn thing in room 237. What I'm right. What I'm saying is, no, okay, we know that we don't want to live in room 237, but let's acknowledge that it's there. Let's hope that we fucking went through it and learned something. And your lesson doesn't have to be the same as my lesson. I just find it, you know, you have one of two reactions, is either this need to disregard, oh, I used to be into conspiracies, but it was just too much, it was crazy. Yeah, I agree. I feel that on a very real level. I feel that. And I feel like there's a bigger thing at play here, which is synchronicity, the universe, whatever phrase you want to throw on it. There is a bigger mystery here. But to think that the one thing stopped being true just because you found a bigger puzzle.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't get devoured, or it didn't change its form just because it connected to a larger, more expansive landscape. That it's still very much a defined landmark in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what do you have? You have connecting the dots, but initially doing it on a more dense or relatable region, which is one of fear, and then kind of applying that same principle and set of dynamics to another level. And basically considering it in a more expanded way. I mean, it's not. I don't know. I wonder about if there's any other way beyond, other than directly through.